History has been one of the driving passions of John Hope Franklin's life. Franklin has received more than 100 honorary degrees, written many books and articles, and he's currently Professor of History Emeritus at Duke University. Earlier this year, President Clinton appointed him chair of the Advisory Board on the President's Initiative on Race. But his most recent foray into the past is a much more personal one. He and his son, John Whittington Franklin, have just edited his father's memoirs, My Life and an Era, the autobiography of Buck Colbert Franklin. The story of Buck Franklin's life is the little-known story of blacks in the Indian territories of the Southwest in the late 1800s. He was born in 1879 in the area that eventually became the state of Oklahoma. Buck Franklin's father was a black cowboy and a successful rancher. Buck was a good student who went to college in Nashville. He later studied law by mail and became an attorney in Tulsa. Buck Franklin's son and grandson are with me today to discuss his life. I asked John Hope Franklin how many blacks were living in that part of the Indian territories when his father was growing up there.
Well, not too many. I think the population was perhaps 5% or something like that. And you see, fairly large numbers of African-Americans had come over in the so-called Trail of Tears, the removal of the Indians and all everyone associated with Indians to the Indian Territory to make way for the, quote, Cotton Kingdom, unquote, that is, the area of Alabama and Georgia and Louisiana. That came to be the center of cotton culture in the early part of the 19th century. So that some blacks, it's not terribly well known, although there have been books written on the subject, some blacks were slaves to Indians, and they were removed. And some were married to Indians or had some other kind of attachment or relationship with Indians. And we represent both sides of that. That is, we had slavery in our family, slaves to Indians, and we had free blacks who were associated with Indians in some way, married into the Indian family and so forth. For example, my paternal grandmother was free. Her people had been free. She belonged to the Choctaw Nation and was a part of the group that, her people were part of the group that came over from the Choctaw Nation into the Indian Territory. My father, on the other hand, was the son of a man who was a slave to Indians, the Bernese, and they were part of the Chickasaw Nation, and they came over at about the same time. And then my grandfather met my grandmother, and the rest is us.
Well, looking at this part of American history and looking at the territories here out in Oklahoma, how did the Indians and the, I guess, former slaves get along together? How did they coexist together?
As a matter of fact, the coexistence was very, very normal. The slave system in the Indian community was not rigid. It was not a great for-profit system the way it was in the plantation area of the United States. They were more or less associated together. The relationship was a cordial one, and they worked very well together.
What was the effect of statehood then on your father and other blacks living in this Oklahoma territory?
Well, of course, by this time, the black population had increased somewhat. I guess by this time it's moving up toward 10%. For blacks were rushing, coming into this area. We're talking now about the 1890s and the first decade of this of the new century. Blacks are coming in this area because it seems to be an area of opportunity. And so the numbers will increase from, let's say, 1890, the time of the opening up of the territory, down to 1907, the year that Oklahoma became a state. And by that time, though, the whites in the state of Oklahoma, or the territory of Oklahoma, were convinced that what was going on back in the old Confederacy was good enough for them, and they wanted to have the same kind of restriction, separation, and so forth, only perhaps more so. so that the Constitution that was written in 1907 at the state Constitutional Convention immediately prior to Oklahoma's becoming a state was more rigid, more segregated, more extreme than perhaps any constitution that had been written in the last 15 or 20 years before that in the Confederate South.
You were born in 1915, and I believe at that time your family was living in a town called Rentiesville?
Yes, very small village. Very small. All black, by the way.
What did your parents tell you about race? In what way do you think they tried to prepare you for a world that looked down on black Americans?
They always taught us that we were as good as anybody else. Race, from their point of view, meant nothing. It certainly didn't endow people with any special gifts, talents, or anything else. That race was, from their point of view, the distinction that you can make between people who are of one color and people who are of another color. And we grew up really thinking that and believing it. And I must say that in the segregated schools, those views were reinforced by our teachers and by our principals.
How much contact did you have with white people growing up?
Well, in Rentiesville, I had almost no contact. The first humiliation I had was when going from the village of Rentiesville to the small town of Shakota where we shopped, on the train, 5 miles, that we sat, my mother and my sister and I sat in the wrong coach, and the conductor insisted we couldn't sit there, and my mother said, well, you know, the train was moving, I couldn't move my children, and he stopped the train, we thought, in order to move us, but he put us off, and that was out in the woods. That was the kind of contact we had. We had a little contact when we get to the town of Shakota and do shopping in the stores there. They weren't dramatic big department stores, but the stores where we got our supplies and our clothing and so forth. We go to the county seat, Eufaula, which was 10 or 12 miles farther south, and I'd have contact with whites there. When we moved to Rentiesville, when we moved from Rentiesville to Tulsa, when I was 10 years old, my contact with whites was greater, although Tulsa was an absolutely completely segregated city. But I went to court with my father, and I was introduced to the judges and the sheriff and the county clerks and that sort of thing. And they were all white, of course. Mm-hmm. And I had some contact with them there.
Well, there was a violent racial conflict in Tulsa. This is in 1921, before your family actually moved there.
And my father was there.
Your father was there. Mm-hmm. And what precipitated this conflict, and how much devastation in Tulsa as a result of it?
It was precipitated by the rumor, underscore rumor, that a young black man on an elevator with a white elevator operator had made some kind of harassment of her. I don't know the extent of it. I don't know. There wasn't any. It turned out there wasn't any, but people's imagination then ran away with the thing, and the rumors were that she was assaulted by him, that all kinds of things happened on the elevator. Mm. When that got out, he was arrested, was put in jail. Then there were the rumors that he was going to be lynched. Then the blacks began to organize to prevent the lynching, and one thing led to another. And before the day was over, before the night was over, there was complete rioting, conflagration. The blacks were rounded up, black men were rounded up and put into detention, places of detention. My father was put in the convention hall. He was there practicing law already, and we were to join him indeed that week, because that was the first week of school being out in Rentiesville. But, of course, we didn't get there, and we heard that there was a riot. We read the paper, which came down to us from Muskogee, Oklahoma. There were no telephones, no radios, of course, no means of communication, and we learned that there was a riot, and then we did not know for days upon days whether our father was living or dead.
And his office was burned to the ground?
Everything was burned to the ground. There was first looting. Tulsa was a very prosperous, Black Tulsa was very prosperous. It's been referred to, you know, as Black Wall Street. It was very prosperous. There were blacks who had businesses and fine homes and so forth. First, they looted the area, and then they bombed it and burned it. It's flat to the ground. In his biography, in his autobiography, we have a picture of the results of the devastation and the conflagration. And there's only one building standing, and that was the high school. And you can see it in the distance in the photograph.
We'll talk more about the life of Buck Colbert Franklin with his son John Hope Franklin and grandson John Whittington Franklin after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our conversation with John Hope Franklin and John Whittington Franklin, talking about their father and grandfather, Buck Colbert Franklin. John Whittington Franklin, when you hear your own grandfather's story, and I know that you were quite young when he died, but do you understand your grandfather anymore, or do you understand this period of history any differently because he lived through it?
Oh, most definitely. The African-American voices I was more familiar with were either from earlier periods than my grandfather's life, slave narratives, the era closer to the Civil War, and then more recent periods, really sort of the 1920s on. This was a void in my knowledge. Mm-hmm. And not only a void in my knowledge, but I wasn't familiar with what was happening with African Americans in the Southwest during this time period.
Well, if I can put this to you, John Whittington Franklin, looking at all the natural resources in this region of the country, what role did petroleum play on some of the racial politics of that region?
Well, you see, at the time when both American Indians and their African American slaves and relatives were brought into the area was viewed as environmentally poor. You realize that the five so-called five civilized tribes were coming from coastal and mountain areas, being brought into relatively desert, dry, savanna area. Then when petroleum is discovered in the area, there is the rush to exploit those resources, and some of that land was occupied and owned by both American Indians and African Americans. And there was the role of my grandfather in helping to defend the land interests of African Americans and American Indians during that very contentious period.
John O. Franklin, getting back to your father's own story, I want to read just a couple of lines that he wrote, and this is really under a chapter he calls The World Today and My Beliefs. And he writes, "While the Negro must ever remain alert and jealous of his God-given rights won in the courts, he must be patient, frugal, and industrious. He must always seek to improve himself in education, cleanliness, and manners. He should never watch the time clock, for a little extra overtime has its way of giving him added insurance when needed. If he has hatred, he must rid of it and never resort to violence or bloodshed as a means of getting even." For you, John Hope Franklin, were these the kinds of words that your family lived by, that he tried to impart to you?
Yes. He, of course, felt it was futile and sort of crazy for anyone to resort to armed struggle, so to speak, for he was absolutely certain that that struggle would be lost. And he felt that it was, he also felt it was uncivilized, and that the power that man's great gift was his mind, his capacity to reason, and he felt that was in the end the way in which we would solve any problems which we faced.
You know, I'm thinking it's such a personal, intimate thing to edit someone's book, but to edit a father's book has got to be extremely intimate.
Yes, it's most intimate. I can't tell you how intimate it is, as a matter of fact. You see, I had this very warm and wonderful relationship with my father, and I was determined to do the best that I could in editing his own writing. But one of the things that was most moving was that as I read his lines, I heard his voice with such clarity and such directness that it was itself a moving experience. Sometimes I would read the lines over and over just to hear him. And he wrote in much the way that he spoke, so that it literally was a very moving and wonderful experience. It was though there was some sort of resurrection, shall we say. And I was thoroughly taken in by it. And when I did that, you see, that committed me more and more to just drive through right to the end. I had been busy those other times, but now there was no stopping me. I wanted to go on because I wanted to hear him some more, and I worked with my son very, very assiduously for the last 2 years.
John Hope Franklin and John Whittington Franklin edited their father's and grandfather's memoir, My Life in an Era, the autobiography of Buck Colbert Franklin. This is Fresh Air.